Welcome to the Revital Health Podcast, where we explore the exciting intersection of modern science, ancestral wisdom, and personalized health optimization. I'm your host, Jodi DeVal, naturopath, integrative medicine expert, and founder of Revital Health Clinic in Perth, Western Australia. Each episode, we'll dive deep into cutting-edge therapies, groundbreaking research, and practical strategies to help you live your best life, having plenty of fun along the way. Whether you're keen to supercharge your energy, balance your hormones, or discover the latest biohacking trends, you've come to the right place. If you love what you hear, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow so you never miss a moment with world-leading experts and game-changing insights. It's time to unlock your full health potential. Let's go!
Revital Health is a proud member of the Health Optimization Network. Health Optimization Medicine and Practice is a 501c3 nonprofit on a mission to educate doctors and practitioners on how to optimize for health rather than treating disease. If you're interested in becoming a practitioner or donating, head over to homehope.org. Revital Health Clinic is the first and only of its kind, exclusive health optimization clinic in Australia with state-of-the-art health technology protocols and personalized care, with compounded medicines made specifically for your testing individualities. To find out more, head to revitalhealth.com.au.
In today's episode, we dive into one of the most urgent and fascinating areas of modern health, the brain. So joining me today is Dr. Amanda Wigan, CEO of the CGP Lab, a neuroscience-led company translating decades of brain research into practical solutions for cognitive health and longevity. With a PhD in neurobiology and over 20 years' experience across research, biotech, and innovation, Amanda shares her personal and professional journey into brain health and how the compound cyclic glycine proline, derived from New Zealand blackcurrants and beef collagen peptides, may be a powerful key to regulating IGF-1 activity, capillary health, and even preventing neurodegeneration. So today we cover Amanda's motivation behind translating research into public impact, the critical role of vascular health in brain aging, memory loss, and neurodegenerative diseases like dementia and Parkinson's, how CGP regulates biologically active IGF-1 and why that matters for capillary integrity and nerve repair, clinical trials resulting results from the type 2 diabetes patients showing improvements in neuropathy, kidney function, and HbA1c, practical strategies to reduce dementia risk by up to 45%, including diet, movement, hearing, health, and social engagement, the MIND diet, homocysteine testing, and why B vitamins and omega-3s do matter, and a compelling discussion around women's health, brain health, hormones, cognitive resilience through the decades. So if you're interested in brain optimization, prevention, and natural neuroregenerative strategies, then this is an episode not to miss. Let's get started.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Amanda Wiggins. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking with me today about your extensive, incredible knowledge on brain health.
So lovely to be here, Jodi. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So let's dive straight into it because I am like itching to get started and hear more about CGP. So talk to me about why you got interested in brain health, what you see coming and sort of like the most exciting things that brought you into the field and some of the breakthroughs associated with this. You know, we've got a big, what I'm seeing in clinic as well, a huge component of brain health issues, dementia, memory, brain fog, et cetera, et cetera. It's increasing exponentially at the moment, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a growing concern globally, actually. So my background is I started studying neuroscience straight out of high school. I went to university here in New Zealand, did an undergrad honours degree in neuroscience. At the time, I was a bit, probably a bit young and naive, and I really wanted to understand sort of the seat of consciousness, what makes us who we are, and is that all embedded in our brain cells type thing? Yeah. I don't think I've quite answered that question yet, but anyway, that aside.
Do we ever?
I don't know if you can answer it, but I went on to do a PhD at the University of Melbourne, which was fantastic, fantastic city, fantastic university, and then did a postdoc in sort of neurobiology at UCSF in San Francisco. I left the academic world about 19 years ago. Towards the end of my time in San Francisco, I'd had a pretty rough, long week locking myself in a dark room, looking down a transmission electron microscope every day, all day.
Yeah.
I just felt like I was seeing double. And I thought, you know what? There's got to be more to life than this. There's all this amazing research going on around the world. I really wanted to get involved in commercializing it and getting out of, you know, an R&D lab and getting science out into the world where it can help people. And did a few other things related to sort of biotech regulations. And more recently, in the last 11 years, I've been working in the early companies here in New Zealand and helping them commercialize science. So yeah, I joined the CGP lab just about a year and a half ago. And the reason I jumped into the CGP lab is because I was just so so impressed with the research that had led to the formation of the company around CGP and what it does and how it works. And there's just so much potential.
Yeah, and that's what I'm really fascinated about, because again, I said to you off you know, camera, it's something that you don't hear about these things readily until someone pops up in your inbox and it's like, wow, look at this. And then you go down a rabbit hole and then the rabbit hole continues. So it's very, very exciting. But yeah, I think that's the thing with research, just to follow on from what you were saying, is it's frustrating, is that you're in the labs, you're doing the research, you're writing, you're spending so many, as you said, hours under huge dark rooms or fake lighting, and you don't always see the outcomes. And I feel it can be frustrating that you're not seeing where it can be reaching or what it's impacting in the wider audience and wider populations. And so that's where you get more now, and talking, I'll sort of jump into a bit more business later on with you as well, and how you can actually start to educate and be, touching those people that you want to, and hearing the success stories and knowing what it's impacting and hearing that. So from a human perspective, it's just so much more that passion comes, isn't it? So it's beautiful. Yeah.
And I think for me, it all came full circle a few years ago when my aunt actually passed away of Alzheimer's disease. And then my stepfather has also recently been diagnosed with vascular dementia. And I think, being a neuroscientist, it just really, all of a sudden, all this kind of purpose came into my life. Like, there's a whole education piece here that I think is missing in the world around lifestyle preventative measures that people can relatively easily make to protect their brain later in life. And, that's really the reason I wanted to, get out there and start speaking on podcasts, because I think there's a bit of an overlooked area. We know that we need to keep exercising our muscles, otherwise we'll get sarcopenia, that muscle mass is very important. It's just as important to keep your brain healthy as well as you age. And for me, that's a key message that I really want to get out there. It's not even really about a product, even though I work for a pretty amazing product company. It's really about the easy, free changes we can make today that will help protect our brain for a lifetime of clarity later. That's where I'm at. I've got a bit obsessive about it.
I think you're right on time. Like you said, I think we've been ignoring this for way too long. I also have my nana passed away with Alzheimer's as well. So it's very close to my heart. I see it all the time within clinic, and now I deal a lot with perimenopausal women, and it's very scary for all of them because the memory loss is a key component of the hormonal changes that are happening for them. And there's a lot of fear that's out there around, neuroinflammation and issues associated with brain function, as well as then the memory side of things, and we know that all aspects, and especially in what I look at in the clinic, you've got gut health, and it can be so complex. I think that's sort of what I'm getting at. And so when we look at it and we can actually have key factors of what we can be applying to our lives that can be really the most impactful, which we'll get into, then we understand a little bit more, we feel more in control, we feel more empowered that we can actually do something about that. So yeah, let's dive in. So what fascinated me and caught my attention, it was blackcurrants. I was like, of all things, blackcurrants. So talk to me a little bit about, more about the CGP and this IGF-1 axis. So this is sort of like a fascinating component of the research and where it came from. So talk me through from, like, obviously you got into the company, you found the research fascinating and you saw what they were doing. So talk me through all of that. Give us a little bit more context.
Yeah. How the company came to be is a really interesting and quite serendipitous story. So before we were the CGP lab, the company was focused on New Zealand grown blackcurrant extract, which in itself is a wonderful thing full of anthocyanins. But the founders were particularly interested in whether blackcurrant extract had any impact on Parkinson's disease. So they had a couple of friends who had been taking blackcurrant extract capsules and they'd noticed huge improvements in their symptoms. Mm-hmm. So they managed to get one of New Zealand's leading Parkinson's doctors here in New Zealand, Professor Tim Anderson, to do a clinical trial where they enrolled Parkinson's patients and gave them these blackcurrant extract capsules for 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the main clinical outcome actually was a significant improvement in mood scores, so depression and anxiety. There was no significant change in the motor scores, which was a bit of a shame. But anyway, after they had finished that clinical trial, they serendipitously went to a conference and sat next to the world expert on CGP, whose name is Dr. Jian Guan. She's now our chief science officer. They managed to convince her to test some blood samples of these patients for the CGP content. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, it won't have any CGP. Lo and behold, there was significantly elevated CGP both in the plasma samples and also in the cerebral spinal fluid sample, so showing that it has really good bioavailability both through the gut and into the brain. So that was really what kicked off the whole formation of the CGP lab. So that was published back in 2018 and the company was formed in 2020. So yeah, but you know, like many cool things in the world, there was a serendipity element there. Yeah. And so it turns out that Dr. Jian Guan, she's spent about 30 years of her life researching CGP, and she's considered the world's foremost expert on the kind of the endogenous regulation of IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. So yeah, it's really that large body of research that has informed the work that we're doing now. And I'm happy. Yeah. So Jian's.
So with the, I'm just sort of, for the listeners and the watchers, so we're talking about the cyclic lysine proline. So maybe just a little bit more of an understanding, because I know it's a naturally occurring compound, which is found in the blackcurrants, but it also, so it's like a dipeptide composed of the amino acids of the glycine and the proline. So maybe a little bit more of a backstory on what that is before we jump into a little bit more detail.
Oh yeah, good point. I'm so jumping so far ahead.
Straight in with just the code words. So
So CGP, as you said, Jody, it stands for cyclic glycine proline. So glycine and proline are amino acids that will be well known to many of your listeners, I'm sure. When you combine those two amino acids under prolonged heat, and even better with pressure, they cyclize. And it's really that cyclized dipeptide that has high biological activity. Yep. So we've developed our own manufacturing process that combines blackcurrant together with beef bone collagen peptides, and it's combining those two together under extended heat and pressure process that actually cyclizes the glycine and proline to form CGP.
Gotcha. Very interesting. So how that, I guess for those who, you know, don't understand in terms of what the difference would be from the cyclic versus just glycine proline on their own?
I am not sure that glycine proline exists as a linear dipeptide. I think that it always forms into this cyclic structure. Okay. Yeah, so the class of compounds that it belongs to is actually, it's an interesting It's one of a number of compounds in that class, which is a word that's too long to say because I know I'll get it wrong. But that class of cyclic dipeptides has been quite extensively studied for its anti-cancer properties in vitro. So that's just a side thing. We're not investigating that. But, yeah, CGP is one of a larger class of sort of anti-cancer molecules, really. But we're not looking at it for that. We're looking at it for its brain health attributes, and it's particularly good at rebuilding and repairing. That's where CGP really, really comes into its own.
And it's fascinating how, so I was obviously doing a little bit of diving into with the IGF-1. And so that's actually, you know, holding that the aspects and the focus of the IGF-1 in the brain, that protective component. So I guess, like, you know, what have you found in terms of, you know, interesting components of what you've and obviously brought into and been into the in this company, and what are you finding to be the most fascinating components of this?
Look, I think it's that homeostatic mechanism of how CGP regulates IGF-1 that's kind of the foundation of the business, really. So IGF-1 in circulation, the vast majority of it is bound to a binding protein and is inactive. And it's only when it dislodges from that binding protein that it becomes active in the circulation, where it can go and do its thing. And it does lots of different things depending on what stage of life you're at. It has different functions in the body. So what's interesting about CGP is it competes for binding to that binding protein with IGF-1. So if you increase the amount of CGP you have in your system, you'll dislodge more IGF-1 to go and be more biologically active in your body. So you're not actually increasing the amount of IGF-1, just the amount of biologically active IGF-1. But here's the other side of the coin, is that IGF-1 is actually fairly enzymatically unstable when it's dislodged and free and going doing its thing. It's broken down within a couple of minutes, and one of the breakdown products is CGP. So CGP is naturally in all of our bodies at a certain level, and really Dr. Guan's headline research is around the ratio of CGP to IGF-1 being one of the key biological indicators of brain health going forward. She's shown that in a number of models, so in a stroke model, Parkinson's model, and Alzheimer's model as well. So that's really that, all of that research was done before she joined the company. Since I joined the company, we've the most exciting thing we've done, lots of exciting things, is that we've completed a clinical trial on people with type 2 diabetes who have the vascular complications of type 2 diabetes, of which there's three, and we can talk about that. We can do a deep dive, but it all comes back to that IGF-1 mechanism, and one of the main things that IGF-1 does from about middle age, adulthood onwards, is to regulate capillary stability and growth. So capillaries, just do a little real quick 101 on blood flow. So blood comes out of your heart, is pushed around through the arteries. It goes through capillary beds, which surround all of our organs, and that, I think of that as like delivering the groceries. It's delivering the oxygen and the goods to the cells, and taking out the trash as well, and then it's going back up to your heart via the veins. So the capillaries are the tiny little ones where all the exchange happens of the good stuff going in and the waste going out. So very, very important for organ health, very, very important for brain health as well. And as we age, I read that the blood supply throughout our brain declines about 0.42% year on year from middle age onwards. Isn't that quite a scary thought, isn't it?
Yeah, you think, wow, so our blood flow would be the same all the way through our life, but
should be. And there's this whole sort of emerging area of research that, you know, really highlights the importance of blood vessel health in your overall health for vitality and longevity. So, that is a long story right there, but CGP is regulating the activity of IGF-1, and in doing so, it's supporting particularly capillary health.
Vascularity. Yeah, we see a lot of that. And I think we align, you know, when we think of vascularity, we think of the cardiovascular system and we think about heart health. And so a lot of focus has always been on that cardiovascular pace of heart health. And yes, of course that is, but the vascularity component, the capillaries, that's everywhere. And we're even talking about, you know, nitric oxide. We're talking about sexual health as well. We're talking about sleep. We're talking about oxygen delivery to all the different organs, neuropathy. We're talking about all these components that we don't, I think, align with all the time. And so is vascular health. And of course, in diabetes, that's a one major component that's decreased, or we notice it more so. So, okay, let's talk about some of this research then. Because I was going to ask you about, because I knew you guys have done a lot more research and you're looking to do more research. So let's dive a little bit deeper into this diabetes study that you did.
Yeah, so we enrolled people with type 2 diabetes who'd had diabetes for a minimum of 8 years, because the thing we really wanted to look at was peripheral neuropathy, which is a vascular microvascular complication. So that's when the nerves, usually in the feet, but not always, it can occur elsewhere, but most commonly in the feet, the nerves start to essentially shrivel up. They start shrinking and then they will start retreating from the feet, and patients feel phantom sensations, pins and needles, tingling, and eventually as the nerve continues to degenerate, they'll completely lose sensation in the foot. So the problem there is balance. One, it's very difficult to balance if you can't feel your foot, and damage to the feet. So you can't feel if you've stood on something sharp or if you have a diabetic ulcer, which can then become infected. And we know that people with type 2 diabetes are somewhere between 8 and 24 times more likely to require an amputation. So peripheral neuropathy is the gateway to very serious patient outcomes, and there's no treatment currently. There's a few FDA-approved pain meds available in the US. I actually read a scary statistic the other day, a paper that said 69% of people in the US with peripheral neuropathy will be offered opioid pain relief. So that in itself is a very troubling statistic.
That is scary.
Yeah. So these vascular complications, there's actually three of them. The triopathy, they're called. So peripheral neuropathy, so that's the nerve one. Nephropathy is when kidneys have leaky capillaries. And retinopathy is the other one. So that's also characterized by leaky, disordered capillaries in the eye that leads to all sorts of problems. Very problematic. We recruited people who had type 2 diabetes together with peripheral neuropathy. We gave them our CGP supplement for a total of 6 months, and we gave them three hospital visits, one at the start, one in the middle, and one at the end. And at that 3 month mark, we found that the patients had a significant improvement in their foot sensation, ability to feel when you probe their feet, basically, and that improvement actually got better in the second 3 months as well. And there were a bunch of secondary improvements in as well. So improvements in kidney markers, and also an improvement in HbA1c, which was quite unexpected. So really.
For 6 months, that's an incredible change.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So when we recruited patients whose peripheral neuropathy was in the medium range, not severe, and not too mild, because we wanted to see a reasonable response. And we're absolutely thrilled with it. That's under peer review at the moment, pending publication. So fingers crossed any day. The cool thing about that is there is actually no treatment available for peripheral neuropathy, whereas there's stuff you can do for retinopathy. So that's when you get a similar thing in the eye. So if you have retinopathy, you can go and get injections of something called as an antibody to vascular endothelial factor. So reduces the amount of overactivity that's happening in the capillary growth. And the other thing we found is that CGP treatment reduced VEGFA, vascular endothelial growth factor A, amount. So again, it speaks to that homeostatic mechanism of regulating the activity of IGF-1, not necessarily boosting it or inhibiting it, but regulating it. Mm. And so what happens in type 2 diabetes is often you get a much higher, you get a big increase in VEGF, which spurs on this really like disordered growth of capillaries, and they grow so fast that they the endothelial lining doesn't form properly and they become quite leaky.
Weak.
Mm. Yeah. So it proved out, you know, in that patient cohort, our hypothesis around that regulating the blood vessel growth. So yeah. That was, you know, it was really a very stunning result, really. Really interesting. I've started doing a bit of a deep dive into blood vessel structure. You know what it's like. You go down a wormhole and you just start reading and reading. So the IGF-1 receptors are located on this particular part of blood vessels called pericytes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and pericytes are part of the cellular makeup of a blood vessel. They're like a master builder. They tell the bits where to go. They tell the endothelial lining cells where to go and to form tight junctions, and they basically work like a scaffold in there, and they help the blood vessel also remain elastic. They help with blood flow and elasticity. But yeah, their main thing, I sort of think of them now after all this reading I've been doing, as a sort of a master builder. They tell everyone where to go, they make sure the build happens properly and is not leaky. We don't want any leaky vessels.
Yeah, no, we don't. We absolutely don't. And I think it's for, you know, normal, for injuries, you know, when we're talking about disease states here, and obviously you're deep diving for these purposes, and we're making the biggest marks on disease states like dementia and diabetes, and as you were saying, Parkinson's and some of these fields. But it's all about that vascularity, because that's, you say, the nutrients and the oxygen have to get to these places to actually be doing the healing, and then to actually give the messages to the master, or give the equipment to the master builders. So we can look at this also for general health, you know, like there's a aspect of like injury prevention, support, you know, even when we get, you know, brain injuries or you know, in sports, you know, anyone who's getting concussions in that way as well. So you can actually be looking at all of these supports for that vascularity in many, many applications. So, but it's fascinating to see the results in the research for the actual conditions that don't have the support already, because you're actually giving some, you know, ability for someone to do something about it earlier on, you know, and actually have better outcomes. So it's incredible, absolutely incredible. So there might be more that you want to say about that, but I do want to dive into a little bit more of your information around dementia. I know we started there and it's close to your heart. And obviously there is a big component of that. And I know you talk about a lot of brain health and what we can actually do. And I wanted to go through that. You know, obviously we have a beautiful product that you mentioned and your company is doing. But you also talk a lot about how we can, with lifestyle changes, support dementia risk and dementia itself by about 45%. So I wanted to dive into this a little bit more. And what does that look like? You know, what are we talking about? We all have our ideas of what it takes to look after a healthy brain and to keep memory and vascularity and everything healthy, including some sleep and glymphatic. You know, we've got all of that there. But let's talk and dive into this now.
Yeah, thank you. There's so much we can do that so doesn't actually involve buying a product, right? I'm really a big advocate of that. You know, I think for me, probably the go-to publication on this is the Lancet Commission's report they put out last year, 2024, on dementia prevention, care and treatment. So the Lancet Commission is a big, very, very heavy-hitting group of the world's best minds on dementia, essentially a combination of researchers, carers, and medical doctors. So every 4 years, they go out and they review all of the new literature that's been published on dementia, and they bring it together in one sort of, I guess you'd call it like a mega meta-analysis. And so that means that only the strongest data pulls through. So it doesn't necessarily capture everything, it captures the strongest areas of evidence. So in their 2024 report, they identified 14 modifiable risk factors, which, as you said, Jodie, all add up to a risk profile of about 45% of a person's risk of developing dementia. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, that's huge.
A huge percentage. especially when it's lifestyle factors, you know, it's how we're living day to day.
Yeah, that's right. It's so fascinating. And what one of the newly identified risk factors was education early in life, which contributed, so lack of education early in life contributed about a 5% risk of developing dementia later in life.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That's surprising because I've never heard it put in that way, associating with dementia. Huh.
Yeah, well, to me, that just speaks to the use it or lose it ethos with the brain.
Exactly.
You know, the brain is just billions of cells connecting, and if you don't use those connections, they will atrophy and die, just like a muscle.
And to be pushed and challenged in those directions.
Yeah, and I actually saw a story recently that said that younger generation, so my generation and younger are less likely to develop dementia than, say, our parents or our grandparents were. And they don't exactly know the reason, but they think one of the leading reasons is women's increased access to education.
I was thinking that, because we were originally just at home and not pushing our brains in different directions, maybe sewing, maybe doing some gardening and things like that, but we weren't actively learning constantly and reading and doing courses and all sorts like we do now.
So it's interesting, isn't it? That's population health playing out at a really macro level. I love it.
No, it is. So what other factors have you seen? And I know for what I look at in terms of prevention and brain health, exercise is a huge component, because we're also talking about the vascularity and the movement. You know, we're making sure everything is staying strong. We're looking after our capillaries and our vessels. Sleep, obviously, for me, I always look at for brain health. Diet is a huge one. So what else in terms of even specifics that you see coming through the research, or what you always are trying to educate more on and trying to get out there more to be able to give people the tools that they need to prevent this?
Yeah, good question. And Jody, you've highlighted some of the key elements from that Lancet report. But, you know, in addition to those, hearing loss was identified as a major contributor to a person's risk of developing dementia. And that was, the hearing loss was attributed with about a 7% increase in risk of developing dementia. So that just says, go get your hearing checked.
Yes.
And if you need hearing aids, do not worry about how they look. Just get them. You know, they're really good these days.
Yeah, they are.
You know, exercise was a really interesting one. So that was identified in the Lancet report. But I was quite surprised to see that they attributed only a 2% risk of physical inactivity to dementia later. I thought that was seemed a bit low to me, because I think, to you know, exercise is one of the easiest things you can implement in your life, right? And should do so on the daily.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to physical activity, you know, gosh, I feel like every day there is a headline in my inbox. This tells you how obsessed I am about reading about this stuff, right? About what is the optimal, you know, what's optimal for walking? Is it actually 10,000 steps a day? Is it something else? Is it something else? I'm like, I just feel like the main message here should be, don't overthink it. Just get out there and do it.
We just need to move, because we're more sitting at desks inside rooms. We just need to move as natural humans are meant to.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, the lowdown on that for me is even 15 minutes of vigorous walking a day makes a massive difference. So, look. I read more recently that people who had walked at least 15 minutes a day had about 16 years longevity as a result. So it's pretty amazing, isn't it? And also that the 10,000 steps a day was just a marketing gimmick made up by a Japanese company at some point.
I saw that recently too.
Yeah.
But we do tend to overcomplicate it. And this is the issue with what we've currently got in the information age, is that we are saturated with information. We get more stressed about it. We get overwhelmed. You know, I have people telling me, well, what should I be doing? There's all these different options for exercise I should be doing, or even eating is even more confusing than what sort of diet I should be choosing. So it really has to be down to what we can fit into our day and just simplify it. Like you say, just move in some way, dance, walk, run, lay down, up and down, up and down, up and down, doing some squats. So you don't have to overcomplicate these things.
I totally agree with you, because I think too much information can just, it can just stop you in your tracks, right? It can lead to just like information overload. Oh, I don't know what to do. I just try to keep it quite simple in my brain. I personally aim for at least 15 minutes of walking a day.
Yep.
And so I've got two teenage children, and I run a company, so I'm reasonably busy. Everyone is, but I can always manage 15 minutes.
Exactly. And it's, again, it's an essential thing to keep your work where you want it to be as well, your brain healthy for the work that you want to be doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I notice such a big difference if I go through a period where I'm not getting enough exercise. I really notice that my brain starts to become quite foggy. So for me, that's a real focus, is staying active. Absolutely have to.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you get into the phase of life I'm at, agility becomes a really important thing. So I'll try to do, as you said, Jody, get down on the floor, get up, get down on the floor, get up five times. Like, oh, it's not as easy as it used to be, but
no,
keep going, you know?
Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed. I'm hitting 40 this year, and I realized how more unsteady I am on my feet, which is just, again, it is this brain, it's the fear centers, there's a lot of things going on, I realize, but going rock climbing now is not like it was 10 years ago for me. Because I'm like,
treading
carefully. There's more fear about falling and doing injuries. So we do have to look after that balance. We have to look after the agility. We have to look after the flexibility and strength too. So there's all of those factors. So in this report in the Lancet, what else were they saying? Was there anything that came out that really, other than this early stage learning, I find that quite fascinating. Was there anything else that they mentioned around the risk factors associated that was something that you hadn't thought would have been?
Well, I think so. They kind of broke it down into life stage. So earlier life, and then kind of most of the risk factors actually sat at the middle of your life, which I found really interesting, because usually dementia is diagnosed after about 70, 75, right? But actually what this shows is that these factors are starting off right in the middle of your life. So like that 40 to sort of 50 period. I mean, other things in there were smoking. Obviously, that's a no-brainer. Excessive alcohol, diabetes, traumatic brain injury. So you touched on that before. So that was one of the newly identified factors as well. So even a small head knock can lead to an increased risk in dementia.
Incredible.
Which is really quite concerning, I think.
It is.
You know, I think of all those kids out there playing rugby, New Zealand's best rugby nation in the world. Just want to get that out there. And taking the head knock. So there's a bit more attention coming on that in New Zealand now, because there's been a few notable retired rugby players who have had really major challenges with their brain health and mental health, and one who actually, you know, committed suicide as a result. So the New Zealand Rugby Union is finally standing up and taking notice. And they've implemented some mouth guards that can detect how much force went on a person's head.
Incredible.
As a sort of proxy measure to what might be going on in the brain. So that's something, it's a start at least. The report then went on to talk about later in life as well, so that kind of over 60 set. And the surprising one in there was social isolation.
We're seeing it to be a massive, huge increase in mortality, aren't we? Mortality rate, it's just something that we are seeing loneliness to be the biggest causer of ill health, but also death. It's horrible.
Yeah, it is horrible, isn't it? And I don't know about you, but if you think about your parents, and it does get harder. They perhaps lose their license, or a lot of their friends start to pass away. They can't do the things they used to do, but there's still a lot you can do. And actually the emerging evidence suggests that, you know, even those passing interactions that you might have in a cafe or a supermarket really spur on good brain activity and really spur on the feel-good hormones. So that's worth keeping in mind if you're out and about have a chat to an elderly person, ask how their day's going, see if they need a hand with their groceries or whatever. That's going to have a big impact.
Such a beautiful thing. I think that's very, very important. We all know how good we feel after someone comes up and have a conversation with us, or how we feel actually just interacting with someone new. And I think that's the thing, isn't it, as well, is like we're growing all of those neurons and those connections by actually interacting in different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing. Like having a face-to-face interaction with another human is like a really rich experience for the brain, right? We're trying to determine, do they like me? Do they not? What's going on with their body language? What is it they said again? What am I going to say in response? That's just so rich for the brain. That's a wonderful thing. And I worry about the younger generation with everything just being online these days. I don't know what's going to happen there.
Yes. I know, I think that's a podcast on its own.
Yeah.
I will get on my soapbox on all of that, because I've got young kids too. Well, not so young. I've got a teenager and a 10-year-old as well. So I'm right in the thick of that at the moment. So it's right close to my heart. And I can see the impacts on the from the brain's perspective, and that's troubling, very, very troubling. And like you say, you've got the coupling of the sports and the TBIs and the small concussions that no one takes seriously. You know, I'm living with the children that are in the sports and seeing some of these head knocks, and no one actually takes it seriously. And I've got a hyperbaric in my clinic, and I have, you know, athletes coming in, you know, top UFC, top basketball, top football, and as soon as they get a head knock at a game, or they've felt like they've hit something, boom, they're straight into the hyperbaric to help support them. So it's something that I think we don't take seriously. And then I see years down the track the implications associated with immune system, gut health, and obviously, of course, mental health. It's really, really sad. So I think for children, it's our up and coming, isn't it? It's something that we have so much impact on in early years that we can now educate and actually support them to then have even lesser of risk factors associated with dementia and brain health disorders.
I think we're living in unprecedented times in terms of the amount of, you know, digital content that our young people are engaging with. It concerns me quite a lot, actually. Mine are a bit past the Fortnite age, thank goodness, but I do remember when they were into Fortnite, and you know, sometimes it sounded like they were on the battlefield, the amount of stress that they got into, the cortisol takes a couple of days to get out of your body. It's very unhealthy to have prolonged cortisol, and some of those games are so addictive too. They're deliberately designed to be addictive for young people. We're getting a wee bit sidetracked, because I'm no expert on that, but I am a mum, so I worry about it.
Yeah, I know. All right, so let's back on track, and I want to talk about actually a little bit more of, so we've talked about the CGP, which is incredible, the IGF-1 axis, looking at that, how we can support, you know, and being at blackcurrant is just incredible. I love that. You know, every time, being the true naturopath that I am, every time I realize a plant has something to do with it, I'm like, oh my gosh, of course, this is the isolated components of it. But let's sort of like swing back into being a CEO, you know, a business owner myself. It's quite a tricky thing to be doing and promoting and being on track of everything. It takes really good brain health when we're talking through all of that. But how do you know, I guess, is that sort of decision of what needs to be translated into the public eye, you know, from what you're finding and what you're trying to research? Does it come from more of a passion perspective? Is it, you know, is there any specific I guess little like gold points that you can talk about that really power you in certain ways, or help you make decisions about certain things within the business?
You know, I think for me, the ethos is you cannot pour from an empty cup. I think as business owners, business executives, mums, the temptation is just to run yourself ragged, right? Because there's always so much you could be doing and so many demands placed on your time. Yeah. I have, you know, the more mature I've become, the more disciplined I've got around saying no.
Yes.
The more disciplined I've got around segmenting off time for myself an absolutely non-negotiable sleep routine, totally non-negotiable. So I could keep working till midnight, no problem, plenty of work to do. But yeah, I make sure I'm off by 8. And so normally I've usually cooked dinner before that. Some, you know, get back online often, but not always. I make sure I'm off by 8. I try to do some very calming sort of yogic exercise style exercises. It'd be a stretch to call it proper yoga, but sort of stretching yoga style. I do quite a simple skincare routine before I go to bed, and I always read when I get into bed, and it just sets me up. If I don't do those things, like if I'm traveling and I can't, or I'm out at a networking event or something late, and I just don't have a good sleep. I'm too stimulated in my brain. So for me, it's about 2 hours before I go to bed that I start getting into that real kind of low key, switching off, my brain switching off, yeah. Chat to the kids, what's going on.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah, the ethos is around you can't pour from an empty cup. And so just really look after yourself. And because if you go down, you know, a lot of stuff goes down around you.
Yeah, so, I love that. I love
that. That's been a bit of a long, long life lesson for me, but I'm there now. Yeah.
Which is good. It's a good when you've made that realization, isn't it? That you're like, okay, this is what I need now. Oh, this is how I be at my utmost or 100% and use my brain the best in the day. I actually need to look after myself. Yeah, it's a beautiful realization and very important for everyone listening too.
Yeah. And the other thing that's just top of mind for me at the moment is just with the, you know, supplements and the regulatory space with supplements, which is reasonably tricky to navigate. So with that diabetes study that I mentioned, we're actually going to develop a different category of product for that indication. So a medicated food, which is also known as food for special medical purposes. That's the long term. And these are nutritional products that can have a disease or condition related label claim. So you can actually say on the packet for the nutritional use for diabetic complications, say, for example, whereas it's difficult to say stuff like that on supplement packaging.
Yes.
Yeah. So
have that differentiation. I think that's
That's right. That's right. It puts it into a more, I guess, slightly more medical category. It's still not a registered pharmaceutical, obviously, and we've decided we're not going to go down that route. So that's just a different kind of product category, and we need to do another clinical trial to get enough evidential substantiation to get that to market.
Okay. And so
I think that's about a 2-year time frame. So.
Yeah, it's not a quick turnaround, is it, with these things when you're having to do the research, because you need to be doing it, and it's evidence, you know, that you need to actually be supplying the public with, and obviously your own backing and information, that's been such a good product. But it's not a quick process by any means.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Or a stress-free process by any means, because there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of backwards and forwards, I can imagine.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. All right. So I wanted to, I guess when you're looking at these within the research, more specifically, but externally, looking at sort of emerging tools and biomarkers, obviously we're wanting to know how to best track or look at. Is there anything that you see up and coming or that you've been aware of or using within the research studies to actually give, you know, more of the tools for us to be measuring some of these components of vascular health specifically and associated with the brain health?
Yeah, there's quite a bit going on in the vascular health space with the glycocalyx. So that's the sort of gel-like lining on blood vessels. And I know there's some tests out there that can test the health of the glycocalyx. There's a lot going on in the nitric oxide space as well. Mm-hmm. So nitric oxide's, you know, essential for relaxing the smooth muscles that surround vessels. Yeah. Those things aside, my personal favorite biomarker for brain health is homocysteine levels.
Yes, totally agree.
Do you? Awesome. Yes.
So there is a huge part of not getting, well, doctors are refusing to test homocysteine in some cases, so it's frustrating.
That's a really interesting one. Same here in New Zealand. The first time I got my homocysteine levels tested, my doctor was like, what? Why do you want to do that? Because it's just not part of the standard panel of health checkups. But so homocysteine is a toxic amino acid, and high levels of homocysteine are very consistently related to poor cardiovascular and brain health outcomes.
Which is,
I don't really know why that's not recognized in mainstream health, but the evidence is incredibly clear. And the good news is, it's relatively easy to lower your homocysteine levels by having a good a diet that's rich in B vitamins.
Yes, absolutely. And I use it, and you see it concurrently with low B12, low folate. And it's obviously it's all part of that sort of methylation cycle. But when you also have such huge implications with neuropathy and B12, which I find so. It's measuring that risk factor, but you can actually have that biomarker in the blood that you can be using to measure it against. So it's so powerful. Again, I don't understand why either. Yeah, you know, I sort of like just mention all the research, and actually, I think it's just not been up with some of the newer information that they're not being taught. You know, it's just not keeping up with that. Yeah.
There's a bunch of good research out there from a group in the UK around taking B vitamins and how the benefits of taking B vitamins links to the omega 3 index in your blood. So that all seems to be sort of connected. So I don't know about you, Jodie, but I do take DHA for my brain health, and I do take B vitamins.
Yes.
As well as CGP, obviously.
Yeah,
I have not taken
that one. So I need to actually have a bit of a start on that to give it a trial. I try everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do too. I take omegas. I tend to measure a lot, and that's the whole premise of the Home Hope. We do a lot of the metabolite testing and the fatty acid panels. So it's easier then to know exactly what I'm needing from a specific cellular time frame. And so I really like to measure in that way. So it will tell it tells me what B vitamins I'm lacking at the time. It tells me what omegas I need to be shifting and changing, because I've had cases in some instances with clients that I actually have, well, they've been overdosing on their omega-3s and not enough omega-6s, which is really interesting. And so then we have other complications, you know, I've actually had like heart complications with having too much omega-3. So I find that really fascinating from what I do within the clinical practice, as I do a lot of those measurements and just be making a lot of different connections between clients and cases. That's my nerding me, I like.
I love it. You're a numbers gal.
I am.
That's really interesting, because I just guess on the omega front. I take Blackmore's DHA. Yeah. I take it every second day because I'm just not sure. I eat a bit of fatty fish too. So
that's it. It's sort of like weighing up between how much you're getting in from the dietary side to then how much you're supplementing. And sometimes if you feel like you're needing more, which I do sometimes, I will take more if I can't test. But again, these tests aren't cheap. And this is the thing, is like the medical system's not geared towards prevention and looking at this sort of stuff. It's only looked at from an intervention perspective. So we need to be maybe, you know, like rallying more to get some benefit out of some of the test costs, so people can get more preventative measurements from, and then know what to do, because otherwise you can't know what to do unless you're testing. Oh, it's fascinating. No, I didn't realize the link between the omegas in that study. So I'll have to have a look at that now as well. Yeah, you prompted me some more reading.
Yeah, I'll send you the link.
Thank you.
That's some of my favorite brain research, actually, that omega-3 and B vitamin stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, really powerful.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So I guess what I wanted to, before we run out of time, there's a few global trends and things that you know want to know, or want people to know about brain health, but women's brain health. I always like to make the differentiation, because not much, there's been very little over the years. Now it's improving with women's research, and we've talked about with our, you know, generation and the generation before ours, knowing that they're going to have more of the risk factors associated with dementia, more associated with that neuronal use and growth. But with women's health, brain health, there is a huge difference in percentage of either decline quite quickly. And obviously there is hormonal implications that we associate with that, but there might be other things as well that we might, or that you've noticed. Is there anything there that you've looked at in terms of the difference between men and women?
This one's a bit of an average one, to be honest with you, but actually women, because we live longer than men on average, that's one of the key drivers. So age is the biggest risk factor for mental decline, and we just simply live a few years longer than our male counterparts. So there you go. That's probably not what you wanted to hear.
No, but that's fascinating from, like, obviously that research perspective and what they're seeing. Is there a more specific increase or association early on after, you know, within the certain year ranges, say from 50 to 70, women are more at risk, or is that just quite even across the men and women?
Women are at slightly elevated risk of brain decline in that middle age and onwards bracket. I think HRT has been shown to have a preventative effect, so putting back in a bit more estrogen and progesterone, particularly for postmenopausal women, seems to be protective. So that's an emerging area of research. Obviously it's not without its risks, but it's worth considering.
I've seen a lot of that come through, and obviously read up and look at that myself as well, and it does look positive so far, which is really
yeah good. Yes it does, yes. Yeah.
Fabulous. All right. So now, what are we knowing for the future in this space? What are your hopes, goals for the company? What are you looking at to be, obviously there's more research to get this new product area out for you, but after that, what is the company looking at?
Yeah, look, the company, I hope I can come back on the show in about 2 years' time and say, here's our amazing medicated food product for diabetic complications.
Yes,
so please. We need to get through that phase 2B clinical trial.
Yeah.
You know, we also want to raise enough capital that we can start to look at brain health and aging in terms of doing a clinical trial there. It takes anywhere between sort of 2 to 5 years to get a result when you're measuring brain health, right, because it's a slow process. So, you know, my hope is that we can do the research to show that taking CGP essentially is extremely beneficial for brain health in middle age and beyond.
I
actually feel quite optimistic around the kind of the dementia and Alzheimer's prevention space. I think every week I see something new and exciting pop up, like whether it's earlier and easier diagnosis, something really interesting, new and different in the treatment space, or just simply lifestyle factors that you can make earlier in life that will reduce your risk. I feel like there's a real growing, you know, almost like a sea change in what's happening in people's recognition around the risk. So I feel optimistic around that. You know, I hope that by the time I get to the real risk age, there's a lot of treatments, a lot of options and testing, and I feel good about where it's all going.
Yeah, no, that's a very positive way to be thinking about it all, which is great. And I don't think we quite got to the point of like specific recommendations. So I just wanted to quickly chat about that. Obviously, we've got the lifestyle factors that we discussed. So there's, you know, the exercise. We didn't really dive into too much on the food point of view because there is so much saturation around that. But if there's anything else you wanted to mention towards that, I'd love you to. But also with the CGP, in terms of dosages, the actual product itself, like what are you seeing in terms of how to take it, when to take it, how long to take it? So we haven't actually dived into any of that yet.
Yeah. Well, there's a bit to unpick there. So just on the nutrition front. Yeah, look, the nutrition space has become incredibly complex and difficult. Yeah. I think when it comes to brain health, the main research I've seen is around what's called the MIND diet, which is a modification of the Mediterranean diet meets the DASH diet. So they're all very similar, almost quite difficult to tell them apart, actually. But what's interesting about the MIND diet is, so that was tested in, I think it was about 1,000 people, over a 9-year period, and in that 9-year period, those who adhered, at the greatest to the MIND diet, had on average 7.5 years less brain aging compared to those who ate less of those foods. So the MIND diet is essentially very similar to the Mediterranean diet, sort of leafy greens. There's a focus on berries for the antioxidants, nuts and olive oil, whole grains, legumes, fish and poultry. So very similar. There's absolutely no red meat in there. But what I like about the MIND diet is it's quite specific around how many servings as a minimum per day or per week. So that's quite nice and clear, and stuff that's relatively easy to do, like just replacing all your cooking oil with olive oil, good quality olive oil.
It's probably similar
to, you know, other just general healthy eating practices.
Yeah, but it, like you say, it's good when it's simplified. I think that's a very easy thing to follow, so it's not, again, too saturated and then too scary and then not done.
Yeah, that's right. So that's called the MIND diet. So if anyone Googles that, you can, you know, there's lots published on it. It's easy to find. And I think your other question, Jody, was just around CGP and dosages and how to take it. So we sell it under our CGP Max range brand, and that's for sale on our e-commerce website. We've also got a practitioner only version. And we've got a standardized CGP dose, which is 40 micrograms per capsule. And we have people usually taking one, but for higher needs cases, two capsules a day. And in our diabetes study, that dose was validated. So we had two doses, 20 and 40 micrograms. It was the 40 that gave the best response. In the Parkinson's study, that was an earlier version of what we make now. That was only 8 micrograms per day of CGP. So 1 to 2 capsules a day with or without food doesn't matter. It's just quite a small molecule that is easily absorbed, so it doesn't make any difference whether you've got food in your stomach. And the time of day also doesn't matter. So we would have many customers that who are on it for 6 months to a year, and many who they come off it and they want to go back on it. I take it. I feel clarity. That's the main thing I feel. I feel energized. So I just think of, you know, blood flow is more efficient blood flow throughout your system. And I feel that. And that's the feedback we get from our customers too, that they feel better.
Yeah, in general. It's hard, isn't it? Without all the, like we said, the testings and the analyses, it's really hard for individuals to actually explain how they feel, especially when there's multiple things that they're doing at the same time. I always find it's tricky, but again, when you're experimenting on yourself, you definitely know if that's the one thing that you've changed, that these are the differences that you're noticing. And so with the dosages, do you find it, you know, again, not more is better all the time, but in purposes of conversation for, say, someone who is more advanced dementia versus preventing dementia, what do you say in terms of dosages for this? Is there a difference?
Yeah, so generally we would, for preventative health and general health maintenance, we would say one capsule a day, so 40 micrograms of CGP. So we do have people who come to us with brain injuries. Stroke, quite a lot of people take our product who have had a stroke. So there's good research, observational human clinical research showing that people who have high levels of endogenous CGP at the time of their stroke have a much better and more complete recovery than those people who have lower levels of CGP. So that research was done by our CSO, but before she joined the company. So I think that, you know, that's out there in the world, and I think people just find that. Because, you know, as a supplement, we don't promote our products for serious neurological conditions, but people find us because that's really the realm of CGP is neuronal repair. That's what it's absolutely best at.
Wow, my brain is just combining hyperbaric with this, and it's just because I already see the benefits from just some of these other technologies. But the combination, what could we do?
So for people who are in that kind of acute phase, whether it's something like a stroke or any kind of sort of really challenging brain situation, we would go 2 capsules a day for 3 to 6 months. and then taper it back to one for a maintenance dose.
Yeah, wonderful. All right. Wow. There is a lot to think about there. That is incredible. So anything more you want to add in terms of what you want to make sure that people know about brain health? You know, that like parting words as such, or statements or information that, and I think you said it really well in that your positive outlook for the space in terms of dementia. But even if it's around the CGP and where that's going, anything else you want people to remember, I guess, you know, like a summarized
summary.
Yeah, what we've spoken about, or that the key points to take away.
Look, for me, the key points are just keep it simple. Just keep it simple. Do not overthink it. Think about your lifestyle and this, and the easy, free changes you can make to provide benefit to your brain, which will of course also provide benefit to your mental health and your physical health as well. So keep it simple.
Yeah, I love your outlook, Amanda. I love the way that you explain information. And I love your passion for the industry and where you're driving this company. And I think, as you said, it's powering in the products that you can actually reach people and the word spreads. And it's that power of talk and sharing that really gives that not only better health benefit, because now we're in communities and talking, but also spreading the information that actually is working and people talk about that, right? I really love what you're doing. And I would love to have you back on to talk about where you are going, or where you have extra discoveries and new products or new product lines that you're talking about. So thank you so much for your time today. So where should people go to find you and the company?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, Amanda Wiggins, and our product is on www.cgpmax.com.
Brilliant. Easy to find. And we'll post all that in the links show notes as well, so everyone will be able to find that there. So thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for your time and what you've spent with me today. I know it's so precious, so I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Jodie. So lovely to connect with you.
Yeah, you too, Amanda. All right, we'll speak soon.
Speak soon.
Thanks for listening to the Revital Health Podcast. We hope you enjoy this episode. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Revital Health, as well as our website, revitalhealth.com.au, for upcoming podcasts, workshops, and speaking events. Find out about specials happening in the clinic and all the show notes and links mentioned in the podcast. Please remember that this information discussed here is general information and is not intended to diagnose or treat individuals. Please speak to your healthcare professional before embarking on any new treatments, lifestyle changes, medicines, or supplementation to assess your suitability. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you again soon.